You are back with The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. At this hour, many eyes are on a time capsule that is being embedded at the state capitol as we mark the anniversary of Hawaii becoming a state of the union. We commemorated the holiday on Friday, but today is the actual day that the islands were admitted into the union. We talked to state archivist Adam Jansen about what's going to be locked up in that time capsule.
We got over 100 suggestions, and they ran the gamut of some really well-thought-out ideas to some, frankly, that probably can't be discussed in polite public. So it was really interesting to see what people were thinking. Some individuals were really thinking toward the future and how they want to, immortalize today's society and the trials and tribulations that we're going through, and others, that have some repressed, angst and anxiety, and how they chose to express that as well. And so it was a real microcosm of all of the things that we're going through right now. And originally we had announced that we were going to announce the top 20 people who had submitted what we felt to be the best suggestions. And it really got to be difficult that we couldn't pick just 20. So the list actually wound up being closer to 30 because there were just so many good suggestions. And that's not to say that all of those suggestions actually made it into the time capsule itself. But based on our judging criteria, there were a lot of really strong suggestions that we felt at least needed to be recognized. The submitters at least needed to be recognized that what they had suggested were along the lines of what we were looking for.
Well, generally, when someone cracks open a time capsule, the contents reveal kind of the sign of the times.
And that's exactly what it's supposed to be. We were really trying to crystallize what is 2019 like, so that, 50 or 100 years from now when they open it, we can give them a real cross-section of everything that we are experiencing right now, not just all the happy, happy, joy part, but also some of the trials and tribulations, our successes and our failures that we're trying to overcome.
So is there anything in the time capsule about TMT, the 30-meter telescope?
That is going to be the one huge unknown story that we're leaving for them. And so to help represent that, there are actually two photographs in there that I have personally selected for my letter as state archivist. We have a photograph of the top of Mauna Kea that we had donated by one of the astronomers of all the telescopes. And then we also had a photograph of the kapuna at the base of the mountain, so that we can present both sides of that story to the future, and along with our hopes that we as a society have been able to resolve this conflict in a way that they would be proud of us, that we've been able to address this in a way that everybody can come together as a society and find resolution.
Yeah, we don't have a crystal ball that we can gaze into to see how this works out.
And that's the interesting thing about it. Because of the time that we've chosen to put this time capsule in, as a historian, that is the one big hanging chapter of this story that we just don't have an idea of how it's going to be resolved.
So you're including it as part of your submittal?
That is correct.
Awesome. Okay. So what else is in there?
So part of it is a big mystery. We're trying to leave some of the surprise to the future. We don't want to give away all of the Christmas presents ahead of time. But what we can disclose is we've tried to replicate as much of the 1969 time capsule as we can. So we have included photographs of the House, the Senate, the governor and his cabinet, and the Supreme Court. And we were very fortunate that we were able to get everybody, all four of those groups, bring them all together at the same time to get those pictures and get those done. We were also able to solicit letters from key notable individuals from the executive branch, the judicial branch, from city, county, to include what their hopes and dreams for the future are as well. so that they can communicate across time so that 50 years from now, this is what their hopes and dreams are. And so, you know, part of our hope for that is that it also places them in that mindset of, you know, we are not inheriting the earth from our parents. We are borrowing it from our children, that we have this obligation that we need to leave the world a better place than what we got it as. And so by writing these letters to the future to help instill that concept of, you know, we have this obligation to the future. So what is that obligation? What do we hope to accomplish 50 years from now? So when they read that, how will they judge us by our actions over that span of time? We have received a letter from one of Hawaii's favorite sons. President Barack Obama has written a letter that will be placed in the time capsule and will be sealed up in the side of the state capitol. And so we're very honored that he agreed that this was something that he felt was very, very important. And so he did write a letter to the future. And in addition to that, he also wrote a letter to today. And so that message will be in the program that will be distributed at the capsule ceremony at the State Capitol Senate Gallery.
When you opened the capsule earlier this summer, I remember being in the room, and when you popped that lid, we smelled a very acid smell of vinegar because something didn't hold up after 50 years.
And that is correct. That was the acetate microfilm. And so that was a very powerful lesson for us. And so the archives has really taken that lesson to heart. And so we've done everything that we know how to do to ensure that what we're putting in the time capsule now will stand the test of time to the best of our abilities, so that when 50 years from now or 100 years from now or whenever the future decides it's time, when they open up the time capsule, that the items that are in there will be in as pristine condition as we can possibly make them. So we've done things like when we asked for these individuals to write letters, we gave them acid-free paper upon which to write their letters to the future. That when we had photographs printed, we had it printed on acid-free paper using 200-year tested ink, so that the color photographs, which normal photographic processes are not very color safe, this ink should be as vibrant 50 or 100 years from now as the day it was printed. And everything is being wrapped in, you know, buffered tissue, and they're being separated. We're using acid-free barriers to separate dissimilar items. We're using cotton binding to, you know, keep everything, you know, bundled together so it doesn't get intermixed and bump up against each other. So we're doing as much as we can to protect and pad and isolate and keep things in neat, organized piles and inventory, and put those inventories on top of each of the bundles. Also thinking that when it is opened, we want it to look neat and organized so that there is a really ta-da moment for the people who open it and also the media who will be there to cover it. Because the one thing that has consistently really amazed us is how ravenous the media and the public have been about the whole concept, about the old time capsule and the new time capsule. And so we expect that to continue 50, 100 years from now when the new one's opened, that they'll be just as entranced about, well, what did they have to share with us? What was the story that they wanted to tell us?
And talk about technology. Because I just wondered, do we have anything digital in there? Is there a DVD or a CD that's going to hold up after 50 years?
Well, that's the one thing that we know. Any tech we put in there will not be readable 50 years from now. So there is a music CD. We do have a Nohoku Award winner who did autograph his album that put it in there. But knowing that that's the case, we are keeping a copy of it here in the archives so that we can forward migrate the technology so that 50 years from now, we hopefully will be able to play that album, where the CD itself most likely will be an 8-track cassette. When we open it, the people who open it will go, what is this thing? I have not seen one of those before. And so we try to avoid technology as much as possible, because while it's such an indelible part of our life today, 50 years from now, it will be so obsolete that the people who open it will have absolutely no idea what it is or how to use it.
Is there anything that you're particularly excited about that's going in there?
What I'm most excited about is the passion that people contributed to this. When we asked for photographs, not only did we get contributors, we had some very notable photographers donate entire collections of photographs to this project. And while we only selected one or two, they were so entranced about the concept of having today preserved, they donated multiple images to the public archives so that we could preserve their work in posterity for the people of Hawaii, for their benefit.
Oh, that's fantastic. So they're part of our record.
And that's absolutely it. And so we're preserving history because of their generosity, that not only are the you know, 2-3 dozen photographs in the time capsule, but we have over 100 photographs that are now in the public archives because of their generosity.
All right. That's great. Hana ho. Thank you so much, Adam. We really appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
That was State Archivist Adam Jansen. We talked with him prior to the morning's capsule ceremony at the state capitol that is just wrapping up.
Dominic Martin wanted to send her daughter to a good school.
I saw how smart she was, and I wanted to keep that.
She heard the state would pay for private school tuition.
And my initial thought was, this is great, this is awesome, because our children can get the same education as kids who are more fortunate.
But the grades are in on the next Reveal.
Tonight at 7, following Bite Marks Cafe.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. With the 50th anniversary of the fabled Woodstock Festival having come and gone, it gives us a chance to explore the Hawaii connection of one of the concert's most iconic performers in today's backyard quiz. Jimi Hendrix, along with his band, the Jimi Hendrix Experience, rocked Hawaii shores a number of times during his brief yet meteoric career. In 1969, just months after his closing performance at Woodstock, the Jimi Hendrix Experience played at the Waikiki Shell in Honolulu, treating the audience to Hendrix staples like Foxy Lady and Red House. The show was well attended, but technical issues kept the concert length at a mere 30 minutes. A year later, they would be back performing at what was then called the Arena at the Honolulu International Center, HIC, now the Blaisdell Center. But Hendrix's most well-known performance in the Aloha State might have been an upcountry Maui gig that residents of the Valley Isle got to enjoy for free. Playing in the shadow of Haleakala, looking out to the Pacific Ocean, Hendrix delivered a memorable performance, the footage of which made it into a 1971 film that shared a name with one of Jimi Hendrix's released albums. For today's backyard quiz, what was the name of that album? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Join us Saturday, August 31st in HPR's Atherton Studio. It's shakuhachi music like you've never heard before. Christopher Blaisdell and Sasha Bogdanovich push the boundaries of the bamboo flute and pan drum in a performance that's both classically rooted and avant-garde. For tickets, visit hprtickets.org, sponsored by Amoresco.
We brought you one historian's point of view about the promise of statehood last week on the holiday. Today, we hear a different view. We talked to Dean Saranilio, Associate Professor of Social and Cultural Analysis at New York University. He wrote a book, Unsustainable Empire, Alternative Histories of Hawaii Statehood. He took part in a statehood forum over the weekend.
If you actually look at the archive and examine the specific kind of key moments leading up to 1959, so whether we're looking at 1893 and the U.S. military-backed overthrow of the Hawaiian Kingdom, and you know, obviously it's not kind of controversial to say that, given that the United States apologized for their involvement in the overthrow in 1993. So when you look at that moment, I was sort of interested in looking at the Hawaiian Bureau of Information, which was a kind of like a kind of propaganda commission that was charged with achieving the annexation of Hawaii to the United States. In 1893, it's also a moment where the United States is in a major economic crisis, right? So there were like hundreds of banks that were closed. There were millions of people who were unemployed. And at the time, Secretary of State Walter Grisham, you know, even makes the argument that what he believed was going on wasn't necessarily just kind of labor protests and labor unrest, but he argued that what was happening was symptomatic of revolution, right? So he's saying this in the 1890s. And when you look at what Grisham is doing and what Blaine, what Benjamin Harrison is doing, the president at the time, Harrison was interested in Hawaii because he viewed Hawaii as stepping stones to markets in Asia, specifically in China. And he believed that if Hawaii were to become a part of the United States, that they could use Hawaii as coaling stations to gain access. And eventually, in 1898, you also have Samoa and Guam and the Philippines. But it was largely a result of economic depression. So it wasn't necessarily the United States sort of being in this moment of strength and this moment of expansion because it was already like sort of capable of incorporating Native American territories into its political sphere. It was actually a moment of economic depression. And then, you know, as I said earlier, you can also look at the 1930s, and the 1930s was also animated by this other economic depression, right, the Great Depression, but it was also animated by a lot of the labor unrest that was taking place in Hawaii at the time. And so it isn't necessarily, U.S. expansion isn't necessarily taking place as a result of strength. Sometimes it's actually a result of the ways in which capitalism is sort of is unsustainable, that there's always these sort of markets that that boom and then bust. And oftentimes, as was the case in the 1890s and then in the kind of sort of 1930s, which is the moment where Hawaii elites have a genuine movement for statehood, it's sometimes not these moments of strength, but sometimes these moments where the state is relying on projects of imperialism in order to make up for the kinds of inadequacies of the economy at the time.
John Rosa talked about a time of hope and fear.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you see that too?
Yeah, I definitely see that. You know, you can look at even, for instance, Reverend Abraham Akaka's sermon, which is a sermon that is oftentimes talked about when statehood is brought up. And, you know, there was a sermon that Reverend Akaka gave at Kauai Ha'o Church in 59, soon after Hawaii is admitted as a U.S. state. And in it, he's talking about the power of aloha. But he also acknowledges Hawaiians who viewed statehood as as a kind of moment of despair, where he says that there's concern that with statehood, Hawaii will be turned into one big spiritual graveyard, right? That things will be sort of commodified and things will be bought and sold, but that the situation, the sort of heart and soul of Hawaii could be potentially lost. And I think you kind of see that crisis taking place today, like whether we're talking about Mauna Kea, right? Or whether we're talking about the ways in which Hawaiian sacred places are themselves, you know, under threat. And that sort of threat is facilitated by the governor or by the president of the University of Hawaii. I think those kinds of situations are themselves systemic and structural. And we are all in Hawaii really fortunate that we have Kanaka Maoli Kia'i protectors who are willing to courageously put themselves on the line to protect these particular places, not as inanimate places or as places that are sort of seen as real estate or as property, but instead as family, actually seen as places from which they need to be protected, because these are places from which life itself emerges from. And so I think with statehood, you had a lot of these different kinds of things. And the other thing I would say about statehood is that, you know, there's sometimes an assumption that the discussion around 1893, the overthrow of the Hawaiian kingdom, the U.S. military-backed overthrow, that history doesn't emerge until the 1970s with a lot of kind of Hawaiian protests, whether it's like via Ko'olawe or, you know, kind of leading to 1993 or 1998. But actually, like, if you look at the record, you know, you have a lot of people who were writing about the history of the overthrow in the decades prior to 1959. So, you know, one person that I write about in the book is a woman named Kathleen Dickinson Mellon, who is from Virginia. She moves to Hawaii, I believe in the 1920s. And when she's in Hawaii, she starts to ask the question, how did Hawaii become a part of the United States? And so she does a lot of reading, but she ends up also being in conversation with Hawaiian women like Abigail Kawananakoa or Alice Kamakila Campbell or Marika Venapuku'i. And in conversation with them, she hears another history. She hears the Hawaiian opposition to the overthrow, the Hawaiian opposition to annexation. She even writes about the Kū'e petitions, which are the petitions in 1897, where 38,000 Hawaiians actually signed these petitions opposing annexation and opposing U.S. citizenship. So that history is sort of all there. And, you know, Abigail Kawananakoa and Kamakila Campbell, they're the daughters of Abigail Kuehilani Maipinepine Campbell, who in 1897 organized the Kū'e petitions, right? So so Kathleen Mellon ends up learning this other kind of history, and she writes four books in the 1940s and 1950s, and also writes a number of articles prior to, specifically in 1957 and 1958. So she writes these four books, but the last book is specifically talking about the 1893 overthrow. And so in the years prior to statehood, the overthrow and the annexation and the question of the United States' legitimacy over Hawaii is under question. And that's sort of a kind of history that I think many of us are not familiar with. It's definitely something I wasn't familiar with. And the fact that you have Hawaiians opposing statehood and citing the history of the U.S. overthrow and illegal annexation, I think is something that we should all pay attention to, and I think it gives us new insight into thinking through the question of the promise of statehood.
We have had different conversations about what's happening there on Mauna Kea, and then also reflecting back to statehood and the wrongs over the years in Hawaiian history. So is there any takeaway?
It's bizarre. It's sort of like seeing history repeat itself. So Lauren A. Thurston, your listeners are probably, some of them might be familiar with him. He's a third-generation descendant of some of the first American missionaries to Hawaii, and he's one of the sort of orchestrators of the 1893 overthrow of the Hawaiian kingdom. And so after he participates in that overthrow, 10 months later, he's actually in Chicago at the World's Columbian Exposition. And so that Columbian Exposition was sort of celebrating the 400th anniversary of Christopher Columbus's so-called discovery of the Americas and the successful settlement of the United States, right? The kind of the ways in which 1890 is sort of imagined as the moment where the frontier has closed. And so he's there, and he's managing what was called the Kilauea Cyclorama. And the Kilauea Cyclorama was this 400-foot-wide, I think five-story-high landscape painting of Kilauea Crater. And it was designed to kind of circle the viewer and give the impression of actually standing in the crater. And the reason why it's of relevance to what's taking place at Mauna Kea is that a lot of the ways in which Mauna Kea is being framed is that it's this division between Hawaiian culture and science. And Hawaiians are sometimes being pitted as being sort of anti-science for wanting to protect Mauna Kea. That has relevance to the Columbian Exposition and Thurston's Cyclorama because, for instance, the Cyclorama, when you walked into the Cyclorama, Pele, there was a statue of Pele, and it was 25 feet tall, and it stood above the entrance, and it was supposed to give you this feeling of being under threat, like this luminous woman who's sort of, she's 25 feet tall, and she's herself kind of looming over the entrance. And when you walk inside the Cyclorama and you look at the landscape painting, the painter actually painted a geologist walking and studying within the crater. So you would walk in and you would feel this kind of threat of Pele, and then a geologist would give you scientific facts about the crater. And Thurston placed large U.S. flags at the top of the Cyclorama because he was using the Cyclorama as a kind of advertisement for annexation. So this is prior to U.S. sovereignty over Hawaii or U.S. control over Hawaii. And so he's trying to use the Cyclorama to kind of win public opinion in favor of annexation. But what you see him doing is he's positioning Hawaiian culture and making the argument that, in that case, white settlers had a more sophisticated scientific knowledge over the crater, and thus they were more deserved over that place, right? So he's, in that example, they're positioning Hawaiians as themselves being kind of anti-science. And what I think is important about that example is that it's not actually a juxtaposition of science versus Hawaiian culture, because Thurston is representing Hawaiian culture on Hawaiian's behalf at the exposition, right? It's actually two representations being set by the same racist imagination. It's two representations. It's a representation of Hawaiian culture and a representation of oneself. And it's not actually a juxtaposition. And so you can kind of see how that kind of minimizing or casting Hawaiian culture as being either unsophisticated or as being kind of primitive, right, is itself working in a favor of Thurston and others. And you see that kind of play out in the 30-meter telescope. But I would just also say that, you know, the work of Keaulani Cook, you know, he actually looks at the exhibit that Hawaiians wanted to use at the Columbian Exposition. And one of the things that they did was they wanted to talk about Hawaiians' contribution to the international scientific movement. So even in 1893, you have Hawaiians from Hawaii, when Hawaii is an internationally recognized nation, who wanted to contribute to the conversation about science in the world. And that contribution ends up being usurped by Thurston, and the representation of Hawaiians instead is that of this kind of like Cyclorama. And so I think there's like ways in which, looking at these historical moments, you can see how these tropes don't necessarily go away. And in the same way that the Cyclorama 100 years later is itself irrelevant, the 30-meter telescope 100 years from now will itself also be irrelevant. But the question of desecration itself will always remain present. And so there's certain things that I think we can look to in these different kinds of examples that kind of help us to enforce. They don't necessarily like give us a prescription to the current moment, but they definitely help to inform our understanding of these different kinds of tropes that come at the expense of Kanaka Maoli.
That was Associate Professor Dean Saranelio, faculty member at NYU, reflecting on statehood.
I'm Bert Lum. Today on Bite Marks Cafe, we'll welcome back Mana Up, the small business accelerator that helps take local Hawaii brands to the next level. Mana Up did a recent launch of their fourth cohort of companies, and we'll have a couple of them on to learn about their plan for success. That's today at 6:30 p.m. on Bite Marks Cafe.
What's a mayor to do? Well, our reality check today looks at just that, now that Honolulu Mayor Kirk Caldwell will term out. Honolulu Civil Beat's political and opinion editor Chad Blair on the line today. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine.
So you found out about a fundraiser that Mayor Kirk Caldwell's got planned, huh?
Yeah, that's what happens when you're in journalism. Sometimes people just slip you a little something, a little tip, and sure enough, a flyer has been circulating for the mayor, holding a fundraiser October 1st. That's at the Wailea Country Club, accepting donations up to $4,000. And what's interesting is the mayor actually is not going to be running again for mayor, right? He's term limited. He will be leaving office January of 2021. But you can still hold a fundraiser. Maybe he was paying off debt. No, he doesn't actually have any campaign debt. So what is he raising money for? Well, I checked with his longtime campaign chair, Lex Smith, who said that the mayor is looking at other political offices down the road once he leaves office, and they include possibly running for governor of Hawaii.
Now, we have heard him say many times, I love this job as mayor, and he wishes that he could stay in that job, but he can't. And so he's got to look for another job in 2022, I guess.
Yeah, his campaign chair did emphasize that the mayor's focus is finishing his term, getting more things done. The mayor, of course, believes he has a strong record and there are things that he needs to do. That still is some time away before he leaves. And as we've already reported, there's a whole bunch of people already lining up to run for his office next year. But the mayor has been active in politics for a long time. He was a former state legislator. I think he was even the majority leader in the House for a couple of years. He was also managing director of the city under Mufi Hanneman a few years back. And I think it's fair to say he has aspirations, even ambitions. I should mention it's not just governor of Hawaii that he's looking at. He's actually thinking maybe he'll run for city council. Isn't that interesting? you don't normally do that as a mayor, you know, go to a council seat. In this case, Ann Kobayashi is term limited as well next year. And Kirk Caldwell, like Ann Kobayashi, is from the Manoa District. So he could do that. Another race mentioned, possibly, challenging Ed Case for the 1st Congressional District seat, which is basically urban Oahu.
So he's kind of, if he runs for council, he'll be taking a page out of the playbook, I guess, of Mayor Joanne Yukimura, because I think she ran for council after, yeah?
Hadn't even thought about that, but you're absolutely right over there on Kauai. You know, one thing that you do by running for office again, and if in this case, if Caldwell were to succeed in taking the council seat, you do keep your name in the public eye. You're a public figure still, and especially with issues like rail and homelessness that are going to be top of mind for many campaigns going forward. So that's not unheard of. I should make clear that with this fundraiser that the mayor is holding, he can use that money for state and county races. So in other words, to run for governor, to run for the council, even a legislature again. He cannot, however, use that for a federal office. You cannot use state and county money raised for a campaign at that level to run for Congress, vice versa. You can't use federal money for a campaign back in the state. So I just want to make sure that everyone understood that.
Now, as far as a run for governor, we've heard of, you know, other names being kicked around. You've done some research on that.
Well, I think it's no mystery to a whole lot of people who have been following the news lately, particularly on Mauna Kea, that Josh Green, our lieutenant governor, has his own political thoughts, political future, even though he just got elected LG last year. He has already held one fundraiser for the position of governor. In fact, I believe it's tonight. He has a second fundraiser. I believe it's at the Pacific Club, also for the position of governor. So even though he could run for lieutenant governor again in 2022, and remember, Governor David Ige is term limited. He can't run again. Green has already indicated strongly by raising money that he is looking at running for governor 3 years from now.
I think it'll be interesting to see, though, if Caldwell does run for governor. He has a couple of fellow Democrats we haven't treated him very well and don't like him that much, I think.
No, you know. Certainly the criticism of the mayor on rail in particular has been strong. Other possible candidates, Jill Takuda, the former state senator, one very critical of funding the rail. She's kept her options open. Donovan Dela Cruz, the current Senate Ways and Means Chair, his name has also been bandied about. However, he's focused on getting reelected next year.
Yes, and I also heard someone tell me that I think Jill might be eyeing the mayor's race even. So lots of possibilities out there for folks.
Yeah, what she told me directly was, I'm keeping my options open.
Yes. How many times have we heard that, right?
Many times.
Yeah, so I guess we'll see how this fundraiser goes and then see what decision the mayor makes.
Right. It's going to be a whole bunch of races pending next year, affect races 2 years, 3 years down the road. But now is the time to think, even though the election in 2018 seems like it was just over last week.
Yes. But anything can happen.
Yes.
Thanks so much, Chad.
Thanks, Catherine.
That was Honolulu Civil Beat's Chad Blair with today's Reality Check. To read his political stories on this issue, visit civilbeat.org.
I begin my day with public radio, so I'm always listening to Morning Edition, and I begin my weekends with Weekend Edition. I find it a very comfortable way to start my day. I get to learn about what's going on in the world, and each day I'm learning something new.
Member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Radio with vision. Listen and see.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we took our listeners on a trip to the late 60s to explore a key moment in Hawaii's psychedelic past. Of the many names and groups that sprang, gained prominence toward the end of that tumultuous decade, few are more influential than Jimi Hendrix. From a guitar-burning performance at the Monterey Pop Festival in 1967 to his iconic rendition of the Star Spangled Banner at Woodstock 2 years later, Hendrix captured the spirit and the sound of the years surrounding the Summer of Love in a way that few others even came close to. Luckily for Hawaii residents, the sound of the Hendrix experience didn't solely exist between the grooves of vinyl records or over the airways of Hawaii's radio stations. On a handful of occasions, the psychedelic rock superstar made his way to the Hawaii Islands to perform a number of concerts. One of these concerts, a free upcountry Maui gig in the shadow of Haleakala, was even captured on film. Rainbow Bridge, released in 1971, was just 1 year after the rock star's untimely death, but it featured the footage of Hendrix staples like Dolly Dagger, Purple Haze, and even features a tune that Hendrix penned in tribute of Hawaii called Polygap. The soundtrack of the film Rainbow Bridge was later released as an album of the same name. And congratulations to Mike Chapman from Kihei Maui. You got it right. Mike shares with us that he went to Seabury, which is right across from where that concert was. That's today's quiz. If you have an idea for one, please send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. This week, state planners held two sharing sessions here on Oahu. It was a chance to talk about what needs to be updated to better manage our coastlines. Tonight, there'll be a meeting on Maui at the Kahului Community Center at 5:30. Tomorrow, it is Lanai. And then again next week on Kauai, Hawaii Island, and Molokai. Last week, we talked to Melanie Lander with the Hawaii Coastal Zone Management Program about the plan.
The whole point of the Ocean Resources Management Plan is to address really complex resource management problems not only along our coastline, but also terrestrially on land, how the way that we develop and conduct our activities on land affect the health of the ocean and the near shore, and how we can address management gaps in our existing laws and rules to address some of the problems that we're experiencing both on land and in the sea.
So how old is this plan?
The plan's been around actually since 1985. So it's a really long-standing effort of the state, and there's partnerships between federal, state, and county actors that go all the way back to that time.
And so we update this plan from time to time. You folks are going to be going across the state trying to get input from the public.
We do. We update the plan periodically. It's actually in statute as a requirement to update the plan. And that's really important because it keeps it relevant and timely because, of course, conditions are dynamic and always changing. And starting next week, we're actually going to be going out to speak with communities and hear what they have to say about their priorities for coastal and ocean resource management.
Okay. And you do this Mauka to Makai.
The plan's really unique in that way because it acknowledges land-to-sea connections and the importance of the fact that the coast isn't just the line where the ocean laps up onto the sand, but that everything we do from the tops of the mountains down into our urban environments and even out the activities that we would be doing out in the water all affect the health of our interconnected ecosystems.
And then is there anything that you can share with us just about how the plan may have changed over the decades when we've had input?
Yeah, definitely. Back in 1985 when it was created, it was actually a lot more ocean-focused. And it was around 2006 when we really integrated the land-to-sea connections element, which I think has really not only strengthened the priorities in the plan, but also the partnerships and the networks that we've been able to build around. The plan really emphasizes collaboration. It's not just implemented by the Coastal Zone Management Program, but by a coalition of partners who work together. And so all of their combined expertise is really important in the land-sea connections aspect. And now we are updating our 2013 plan. And so we're really focusing on local resource issues. Of course, climate change has become a big factor in some of the decisions that we make. And we're also looking to incorporate a lot more traditional ecological knowledge into this iteration of the plan. And so really hoping to hear from communities about the way that they utilize resources, what's important to them, and how they envision the future.
And I know there's lots of discussion about, you know, the land uses and where people congregate more, whether it's because we have more visitors or a particular beach or area is more appealing for whatever reason. But I guess that's part of the whole picture, right? Figure out, well, maybe we need to move more activity and spread it around versus maybe concentrating it in one area.
Yeah, that's absolutely something that we could hear in these information sharing sessions. I think tourism is a concern that has been a growing rumble. You're hearing a lot about it in the media lately, particularly when it comes to tourism. I think it's a good example of how resource management issues along the coast are very complex because as much as we rely on tourism as a big facet of our local economy, and of course, all of the people who live here also enjoy locally recreating on the beach and using our ocean resources. We also want to support the unique longevity of our ecosystems. And I think Hawaii is really unique in acknowledging the value of ecosystem services as well. And so trying to balance and marry those two competing interests is something that we're working on actively and really hoping to hear from the community about.
I know right now our community on the North Shore is grappling with a situation of traffic and people trying to get access down to the beaches where there are turtles and mm-hmm. you know that situation at Laniakea, and you know, and maybe you'll hear some of this when these meetings go around the state, but there is that conflict.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, there's actually a lot you could unpack just in the example of Laniakea. You have an ecosystem with its own intrinsic value. Then you have tourism and people who are spectators to the beauty of that ecosystem and the turtles who are nesting or resting there. You also have traffic and industry along the highway. And then you have local people's competing interests in just getting to and from their homes, as well as people who are visiting the island. And so you could really go on and on. To add to that, you could add in future conditions that we're anticipating and add greater uncertainty, like the condition of the road and whether rising sea levels could impact or further compound the issues that we're experiencing up there. So that's actually a great example.
Right, because you're like, where's the planning, right? And what struck me in reading these stories that we've been hearing about for the last several weeks is folks were saying, well, you know, there are turtles everywhere. There are other places that you could go see these turtles. But mm-hmm. for some reason, the social media is driving everybody to this spot, and it's creating a problem, creating tension.
Right, right. Yeah, social media has definitely contributed both positively and negatively to the situation. For instance, you know, social media is one of the ways that we can reach out to more people to get their input on this plan. And we have an online survey that you can fill out if you're not able to come to our in-person information sharing sessions that I would definitely encourage people to check out. And so it can make us a little more nimble. But then, of course, like you mentioned, on the other hand, it can aggregate people in areas that previously maybe were more of local spots or a little bit more untouched. And it's definitely understandable that those are areas that we'll be hearing about and areas that we do want to address and we're excited to take on as challenges. And when you say it's where's the planning, it's funny because, of course, these areas were planned out, but a long time ago. And some of the decisions that were made then just don't stand up today's conditions, like the number of tourists that we have coming into the state.
And that's why we need to update this plan.
Yeah, exactly. There's the relevance with periodically updating, and we tend to update about every 5 years or so. But it's not just tourism. The conditions becoming more uncertain with our weather and
erosion.
Erosion, coastal hazards. It's a really interesting time to be an urban planner for that reason, because everything is incredibly dynamic and the pressure's on. So it's the perfect time for people to come out and let us know what they're thinking. We're going to try to go to as many spots as we can, hosting 2 meetings on Oahu and also 2 on Hawaii Island. And then we'll be visiting Kauai, Molokai, Lanai, and Maui, just to get as much data as we can. And it's all going to be qualitative. And then what we're going to do is we're going to take the input that we get from communities and actually bring it directly to our agency partners who collaborate on these issues and get their feedback. From there, we'll distill some of those management gaps that could potentially be addressed, whether it's through new legislation, research, or the provision of other information that decision makers need to tackle some of these complex problems.
Okay, so you want to find out what's the problem in your neighborhood, on your coastline, and then you'll work at the solution.
Exactly.
Okay, and the dashboard. So if people can't make these meetings, they can go online and also then track the progress and the changes to the plan.
Yeah, exactly. There's a couple options for people if they can't make the in-person meeting. We have a survey on our website that they can fill out, which has some of the same questions that we'll be asking in the in-person meetings, and so they can definitely participate in that manner. And then if they want to learn more about the plan, they can visit our Ocean Resources Management Plan dashboard, which is a standalone website that tracks the progress of all of our partner agencies in implementing the plan.
And then do you have like a hotspot list? I mean, here on Oahu, it's the Laniakea hotspot, because that's happening now. Any place else on the neighbor islands that you can mention where there
friction? Well, I think we definitely have things in mind, you know, just personally from staying up to date with what's going on in the news. But the information sharing sessions is really where we're going to try to more professionally aggregate that type of information. What's coming up? What are the patterns that we're hearing from communities? And do those issues resonate statewide?
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
We sat down to talk with Melanie Lander, who is a project analyst with the Hawaii Coastal Zone Management Program, last week. So again, tonight's the Maui meeting. Tomorrow there's a meeting on Lanai. And next week it is Molokai, Kauai, and 2 meetings on the Big Island. For more information on the Ocean Resources Management Plan statewide information sharing sessions, find the links on our website. That's it for today. Tomorrow we look at the growing lava lakes on the Big Island. Tell us what you think. Suggest a story idea. Call or talk back line. Here's that number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Find us on Facebook at The Conversation HPR or Twitter at HI Conversation. This show and all our past ones available on The Conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.